Okay, let's turn in our Bibles to Acts chapter 4. The topic this morning is sharing, deception and healing. Quite a topic, isn't it? And it's been quite a challenge, and I trust this morning we'll all learn from it. Let's just read it, shall we? Acts chapter 4, starting in verse 32. All the believers were of one heart and mind. No one claimed that any of his possessions was his own, but they shared everything they had. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and much grace was upon them all. There were no needy person among them, for from time to time those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the house from the sales, and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone as he had need. Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement, sold a field he owned, and brought the money and put it at the apostles' feet. Now a man called Ananias, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property. With his wife's full knowledge, he kept back part of the money for himself, but brought the rest of it and put it at the apostles' feet. Then Peter said, Ananias, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept yourself some of the money you have received for the land? Didn't it belong to you before it sold, and after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You have not lied to men, but to God. When Ananias heard this, he fell down and died. And great fear seized all those who heard what had happened. Then the young man came forward, wrapped up his body and carried it out and buried him. About 3 hours later, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened, and Peter asked her, tell me, is this the price you and Ananias got for the land? Yes, she said, this is the price. Peter said to her, how could you agree to test the Spirit of the Lord? Look, the feet of the man who buried your husband is at the door, and they will carry you out also. At that moment she fell down at his feet and died. Then the young men came in, and finding her dead, carried her out and buried her beside her husband. Great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events. The apostles performed many miraculous signs and wonders among the people, and all the believers used to meet together in Solomon's colony. No one else dared to join them, even though they were highly regarded by the people. Nevertheless, more and more men and women believed in the Lord and were added to their number. As a result, people brought the sick into the street and laid them on the beds and mats so the least Peter's shadow might fall on them, as he passed by. Crowds gathered also from the towns around Jerusalem, bringing their sick and those tormented by evil spirits, and all of them were healed. Quite a chapter, isn't it? A lot of verses there. Well, I guess it would be no news to you that John Howard has had a pretty tough week, hasn't he? Now, I wrote this note before last night, right? I think he had a bit of encouragement last night, didn't he? But up until last night, he'd had a pretty tough week, hadn't he? And when any new government comes in, we say there's a honeymoon period. Usually about 100 days, they say. And things go pretty well. They get the new ministry together and they're all fired up. Aren't they? You wait after Clinton gets in the second time, which I imagine will be the case, there'll be a honeymoon period, especially when there's a change. And it was said by Mr. Beasley even last night when he says, you know, he thought the honeymoon was over. He even used that word, honeymoon. Because things were getting a bit rough in the Liberal Party this week, down there in Parliament House, with two resignations, and you know the rest. But the same here, in this story here, I believe it's come to a point as we get to the beginning of chapter 5, the honeymoon is over. It's beginning to get tough. You imagine what's gone before. There's been the euphoria attached to the Lord being there. There's Pentecost. And all that brought. And then there was Peter, got up and preached to the crowds, and 5,000 people were saved. There was the fellowship described there at the end of chapter 2 of all the believers. And they're key verses, aren't they? We've read them here, I'm quite sure, as we have in many of our churches. Peter speaks to the onlookers. Peter and John defend their case to the Sanhedrin. And they're amazed at these men. And then there, in the halfway through, just before what we've read, we find that believer's prayer, which is such a powerful prayer. And then we come here to today's passage where the believers are selling their possessions. What a chapter! What a chapter! And then we come to Ananias and Sapphira and we find the honeymoon is over. There's an attempt here to corrupt the church. And we'll look at that in a moment. John Stott says this of the early church, that there is an attempt by the early church, by Satan, to derail the early church. Firstly, as in chapter 2, there's the physical oppression that began. Here, in chapter 5, there's the moral compromise. And thirdly, which you'll cover in a couple of weeks, I'd imagine, in chapter 6, there's the attempt to distract the apostles from prayer and teaching by getting them involved in the administration of the funds for the widows. So, but today we're going to be looking in part to the possible distraction of moral compromise. But firstly, let's think about this aspect of sharing. In chapter 2, I referred to that at the end of the chapter, we find these sorts of words characterising the church. All the believers were together. There was fellowship. They were one heart and mind. And I guess we've read those verses and we think, wow, you know, that must have been great in that church. Are all together, all of one, common purpose. And I guess we reflected on our own situation, whether it be Parramatta where I go or here or any other place. And it's not always as harmonious as that, is it? And so here we find the picture of the church. But we then find here in chapter 4 that this church, this church that's almost ideal, is taking it to a new dimension. What is happening? No one claimed their possessions as their own. Shared everything they had. There was no needy person among them. From time to time, they sold their houses and land. They brought the money to the apostles and they distributed to anyone in need. It's not just confined within the home or the church walls, is it? Where they're just together. It has a practical outreach to those around. It's touching the lives of those who are poor, those outside the church. I guess we read these verses in the end of chapter 2 many times, don't we? But we don't often tackle chapter 4 and work out the practical applications that come to mind here. It seems here that this whole thing of selling was driven by the situation. Let me explain. Some people have sort of called this as Christian communism, right? Selling everything they have and saying, well, listen, this is the communist model. But I don't see it that way. You think of the communist model, and it is one where they sell what they have and give to the state. They don't own anything. Right? But that's not what's happening here. People are seeing the poor, and they say, we can't let that situation continue. I've got some way of being able to meet that need. And they're being driven by the situation there when they see that poor person. The communist has an ideology that he's trying to uphold. And that's why it goes to the state. It's not driven from the poor person. So I see it not as Christian communism. I see it as a heart response, a compassion to the poor person there in the city of Jerusalem, there in the early church. We see there, I take that, in verse 34, there were no needy person among the poor. From time to time, those who owned lands or houses sold them, brought the money. See, from time to time, it wasn't a blanket thing that says, sell all you've got and give. From time to time, they saw a situation where there was a situation of poverty, and they would respond by selling and giving to that situation. It wasn't a blanket rule that you had to sell, as is the case with communism. Well, how does this apply today? Do we sell what we've got? Well, do we give our money to the leaders and see for them to spend as they see fit before the Lord? I'm not sure that's the way it should be. But I believe it's time for us to radically think about the way we spend our money. Let me highlight two things. You may have noticed on the TV news this week that a report has come out, and in the Western world, Australia is second behind the USA for having poverty in the level of poverty amongst under 15-year-olds. Australia has 14.1% of under 15-year-olds are living below the poverty line, whatever that is. In the USA, it's 23%, which is rather surprising. That's in the Western world. It doesn't include Bangladesh and India and other places. It's the Western world. So even in our own country, we have poverty. We have a girl in our assembly who works amongst the street kids in Parramatta. There's poverty in our city. But then there's something else I'd just like to highlight to you. I've got a map here. And this is an up-to-date map. It's a map of status of world globalisation for 1996. That's this year. Alright? Those countries that are green are the countries that are, by the definition they have here, are evangelised. The countries that are red are those countries that they say are unevangelised. See where it is? Right in the middle. Some missiologists have a definition for that area there. Basically, all the red area fits into what they call the 1040 window. The area lying 10 degrees north to 40 degrees north of the equator and from Africa across to Asia. Right? It's called the 1040 window. And nearly all of that red area fits in it. That is unevangelised. 96% of the world's unevangelised people live in that area. Massive amount. Massive numbers are unsaved in that area there. Do you know how much of our budget we send there? 1.2%. 1.2% of our budget is being used to try and reach 96% of the world's unevangelised. Do you think it's time for us to think radically? The same as the early church was thinking radically by selling what they had and giving to the poor, perhaps the time has come in our own Christian community worldwide to start addressing the issue of how we spend our money. Most of our money goes to support people in the West. Only 1.2 goes to try and reach the 96% who yet don't know Jesus Christ as Saviour. So, I think it's time, as a church, wide church I mean, to start thinking. How do we do that? Well, maybe the practical thing is to look at our budgets. Parramatta, should we look at our budgets and say, well, listen, how are we spending our money? Where's it going? Let's try and see if we can't at least start to address the problem of increasing the giving to this part of the world. We might say, well, listen, nothing's going there at all from our church. And so we might say, listen, let's set at least a target of 10% or 20% or whatever it is so that we can start addressing this issue of reaching these people for Christ. First point on this one of sharing. Let's be a people who are people who share our resources that God has entrusted to us. Right, deception. We've read through this story of Ananias and Sapphira, and I'm sure we've read it before, and probably you've heard teaching on it as well. But I don't know, I'd imagine, well, let me not assume. There are times when I was a younger person, I heard this, and I thought, wow, that's pretty tough. No, these guys made one mistake, and bang, they die. So I don't know if you've ever thought it was pretty severe. Just perhaps in a wild moment, you just wondered, wow, that's a pretty tough thing to happen. Why didn't somebody go out and tell Sapphira, say, listen, you know, when you come in, just be careful, your husband's already gone. Because there was 3 hours in between. But that doesn't happen. She comes in and she follows the cue. And she goes as well. Why the severity? Why the severity? You know, somebody said that compared Ananias to Achan in the book of Joshua. In fact, F.F. Bruce has written this. The story of Ananias is to the book of Acts what the story of Achan is to the book of Joshua. In both narratives, an act of deceit interrupted the victorious progress of the people of God. In Joshua, remember, the people were marching in, taking cities, and then suddenly they send off to another city and they are defeated. And Joshua said, "Hey, listen, Lord, what's gone wrong?" They said, "There's sin in the camp." And so they had to eradicate that, because one man chose to deceive. And here in the early church, there was an opportunity for Satan to get a foothold. And it was to be eradicated. You know, the word here used, it says here, with a wise full knowledge, he kept back part of the money, kept back. I'm told, from what I've read, that the sense of this word conveys the idea of embezzlement, an act of stealing, withholding something that you have agreed to pass on and you haven't, so you've embezzled it, you've kept it for yourself, you've kept it back. There's one other time in the New Testament the same word is used, and that's translated on that occasion as stealing. And in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the same word is used of Achan's sin. Right? Achan's. It's an act of embezzlement. So maybe Ananias and Sapphira had come to the apostle and said, "Listen, we'd like to respond to this poor situation, and we'd like to sell our property, and we're going to give it all to you for you to dispense." And so the agreement was they would give all their money to theirs. But they kept some of it back. Maybe they were going to do a house extension, I don't know. But they kept some of it back. Now, was there anything wrong with keeping it back? If they hadn't have made the first statement, there was nothing wrong. They could do whatever they did, and Peter outlines that. He says, you could have done whatever you like with that money. But you had agreed to give it all. And notice when Nana and when Sapphira comes in, Peter chooses his words very cheerfully, doesn't he? "Tell me, is this the price you and Ananias got for the land?" "Yes," she says, "this is the price." But she kept it back. And so she also died. So, pretty tough, isn't it? But here in this fledgling early church, God saw fit to see this situation come as a lesson to those around. And it certainly was, because what does it say in verse 11? Great fear seized the whole church and all who heard these events. Do you think you were going to do any embezzlement the next day after this situation? No way. It was a lesson to all that they shouldn't do it. Well, John Stott says there are three things we should learn from this passage. Firstly, the gravity of sin. The gravity of sin. This wasn't... Who believes in little white lies? You know, little white lies God calls sin. Right? He calls adultery sin. He calls embezzlement sin. And he calls little white lies sin. That's God's definition. And we need to realise the severity of sin. Sin is falling short of what God has said. Sure, we can be forgiven from it and all that sort of thing. But when we do wrong, it is sin before a holy, just God. And we need to remember that. It's not just a little, well. It's severe. It's wrong. The second thing that John Stott says, the importance of the human conscience. The importance of the human conscience. When we do things that are wrong, we know they're wrong, in most cases. We know when we're saying something that hurts somebody, or we know when we keep that change that we shouldn't be changing, or whatever it might be. There's something within us that says, "Hey, listen, Andrew, what are you up to?" All right? But the Bible shows, firstly, that we have been given a clear conscience by a holy God through the act of forgiveness. In Hebrews 10 we learn that. But the other thing is that we can damage our conscience. We can sear it. We can burn it. We can make it less sensitive to the Spirit of God to use as a reminder. And so we need to make sure that we don't do those things that are going to sear it and damage it, but do those things that will keep it fresh, like reading and praying and being in communion with God, because that will keep it fresh and vital, and it becomes more reliable as a way of determining right and wrong. Not the only way, but a way of determining right and wrong. The third thing that is pointed out from this passage is the necessity for church discipline. This area has changed over the last generation, hasn't it? The way, the idea of church discipline. In fact, we don't often hear those words together, church discipline, nowadays. But I would suggest that it's necessary from time to time. But might I suggest that perhaps in the past we haven't always done it right? We haven't always shown in a sense of love and compassion. We've been fairly harsh in the way we've dealt with it. We're reminded in Galatians chapter 6, brothers, if someone is caught in sin, you who are spiritual should restore with gentleness. But watch yourself, or you may also be tempted. Let's be careful in the way we deal with those who have fallen. I'm just reminded, just the other week I was in Adelaide and I spoke to this brother who I highly regard, and he was just telling, he was saying how his granddaughter had relayed a situation in her church, which was in another city, and said how that this girl had been away and come back and she was pregnant, and she was remorseful and all that. And as it was announced to the church that Sunday morning, the church was just, it was such a surprise, because this girl just didn't fit into that category. And this brother, who I highly regard, said to his granddaughter, he said, I just hope that after that announcement was made, somebody went up to her, an elder went up to that girl and put his arm around her. And the granddaughter said, actually, there were two. There were two. And to me, that's the way it should be done. In an act of compassion, caring, to see that person come back. That's the purpose. So let's think of church discipline with the hugs, not just on its own, because I believe they go together. Remember also that our action has consequences. I could do something that would blow my ministry or whatever, my family. And I think, you know, our actions have consequences. They affect, if I did something like that, it's not going to just affect IT or my church or my family. It's going to affect a wider community, because our actions have consequences. So let's just be careful on that. Okay, the subject of healing. How do I get this? Okay, let's go. The idea of healing. Here in this early church, we find the apostles were doing a marvellous work of seeing men and women being to be healed from their diseases. There they were doing it, the Solomon's colonnade, there on the temple. And there it is, it says signs and wonders. You see, this was also authenticating the people, these apostles' message. They were proclaiming and people were coming to know the Lord, but also we find that there was these acts of healing, which helped the poor, which helped the destitute to be able to be to hear the message. But it's interesting to note that even though there are all these things going on, what is said? Not everybody believed. What does it say there? No one else, verse 13, dared join them, even though they were highly regarded by the people. I don't know why that was. Maybe because of the situation of Ananias and Sapphira, I don't know. But it's there. So there was a reticence. But then verse 14 says, nevertheless, more and more men and women believed in the Lord and were added to their number. So while there were those who didn't join, there were those who didn't. Isn't that like today? You can preach the gospel and you think you've done it well and the Holy Spirit is there, but some believe and some don't. Why? It has been said, this paradoxical situation has often recurred since then. The presence of the living God, whether manifest through preaching or miracles or both, is alarming to some and appealing to others. Some are frightened away, while others are drawn to faith. The Spirit of God calls those he wants to call. Some respond, and others don't. What about healings today then? A few years ago, my son had when he was only 18 months or something, a sister-in-law kept on saying, "Oh, I can't understand what he's saying." So he took him along to a speech therapist, and he had a little lazy muscle in his tongue, and it was affecting his diction. And so he had some speech therapy, and the problem got better. The problem got better. But then, when we stopped seeing the physio, our son developed this speech impediment. I thought, oh, good grief, you know, you sort of jumped the frying pan in the fire. What's happening here? And so we go back to the speech therapist and say, "Well, listen, you know, this is now the problem." They said, "Oh, well, you know," she did some tests. He said, "Yeah, he's got a problem." He said, "We could fix that, but it's going to cost you $1,000. I said, "Oh." Now, this is way back in the early 80s, and $1,000 is a lot more than what it is today. I said, "Oh, hang on, Lord, what are you doing?" So I can remember, I said, "Lord, I don't want to spend $1,000. Some speech therapist is going to get it. As good as they are." And I said, "I am asking you to heal my son." You know, a week later I suddenly realised he doesn't have the speech problem. And he hasn't had it since then. Not even an indication of it being returned. And I guess inside this very building, we have prayed that God will heal people. Not in some great grandiose way, but you've prayed that God will heal people, and I'm quite sure that God has answered that prayer from time to time. Let me take you to the streets of Manila. There's a man there who works there in the squat areas. Do you know how many, I don't know how many doctors there are per 1,000 people in Australia, but in Manila, amongst the squatter people, there are next door to none. Next door to none. And there is so much sickness, many people have got TB and lots of diseases. We've got a worker there, and she has got a skin condition that is direct. The doctor has said, "If you want to get rid of that skin condition, you stop your ministry and get out of the slum areas." But she said, "I want to stay there to minister to the sick." And she's got the skin condition, and she always will until she gets out. There's a lot of sickness there. And this worker we have there, one of his roles is to pray for the sick. He goes, not in some big grand thing, but he goes into one of these little squatter homes. This would be a mansion to some. Little rooms, no bigger than this area, half. And that's their home, for sleeping, eating, for a family of four or five or six. And he goes into there and he sees somebody who's sick, and he prays for them. And they're healed. He might do that a couple of times a day. And these people are being healed. I'm saying what's happening. Alright? It's happening today. As I said, not some big grand way, but going from house to house. And we're seeing people being healed. But you know the other thing? They're being healed physically, but they're also being healed spiritually. Because if you've got this sickness and there seems to be no hope, and somebody comes along and he prays for you and you are healed of this sickness, aren't you going to listen to the message he's going to carry? And that's what's happening. And this man has been an instrument in seeing at least 8 churches start amongst the squat areas there in Manila, amongst the squatters. God heals people today. It's a subject perhaps we don't often touch on, but it's happening. I'm not saying we shouldn't see our doctors, but maybe it'd be good even just to pray for our sickness even before we see a doctor. All right? Might be cheaper. All right? So let's think this through. Let's remember to ask God. He's the master physician.